The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is David Barsamian, a radio producer, journalist, author, and lecturer. David is the founder and director of Alternative Radio. Alternative Radio can be found on the web at www.alternativeradio.org. It's the independent, award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Barsamian has written articles and interviews that have appeared in the Progressive and Z magazine. He's the author of numerous books, and we're going to talk today about two of his most recent books, Louder Than Bombs, a collection of interviews from the Progressive magazine, and a book of conversations he had with Arundhati Roy, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile. It is my great pleasure to welcome my dear friend and one of the great figures in independent media in the United States today, David Barsamian, to Media Matters. Hello, David.
Hello, Bob. I'm really flattered by your kind words. Thank you very much.
Well-deserved, if I may say so. And let's talk a little bit about alternative radio. And I think many of our listeners are well aware that WILL AM 580 here in Urbana-Champaign carries alternative radio every Saturday evening at 6 p.m. So people are familiar with the show. They can listen to it, and they can also go to the website at www.alternativeradio.org to get information on it and archive the old shows. But what is alternative radio? What was the point of it? How long has it been around? And what do you try to do with the show, Alternative Radio?
Well, it's been around since 1978, and I really want to stress to some of your younger listeners that I have no background in what I'm doing. I'm entirely self-taught. I just decided that I wanted to be a kind of tonic to the corporate control of the media and the kind of monochromatic one-note samba that they constantly churn out. So I began here in Boulder, Colorado at a community radio station, KGNU, and I made lots of mistakes, and I learned editing skills and producing and announcing and writing and narrating and all the things that go into doing programming. And then in 1986, I decided to go national with the broadcast, and it's now carried on over 100 radio stations throughout the U.S. It's coast-to-coast in Canada, I must say, from Halifax to Victoria, in every major city in Canada. It's all over Australia, and so the program has been this weekly 1 hour that has featured dissident voices, voices that are usually marginalized or completely omitted from the kind of golden Rolodex of pundits that one is usually exposed to in the mainstream media. So I feature voices like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and Michael Parenti and Angela Davis, some of the luminaries on the U.S. left that tend to be neglected. But also, I'm very proud that I've been able to introduce a lot of voices from the third world that really don't have an audience here. People like Nafiz Musaddeq Ahmed, who's of Bangladeshi origin. He's only 25 years old. He's entirely self-taught, brilliant analytical mind. Rania Massari, who is a Lebanese-American, a very, very talented and gifted woman. Voices like Pervez Hoodboy and Zia Mia from Pakistan, Vandana Shiva from India, Arundhati Roy from India.
Yeah, and let me stop you there, David Barsamian, at that point, because the first I heard of Arundhati Roy was listening to alternative radio a few years ago, and I was driving along the road, and I think a lot of listeners have had this experience when they're listening to alternative radio, and I'm hearing this brilliant lecture, and I have no idea who the person is. And you might remember this, David, because I think I called you.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, who is that fantastic speaker? And then you said, oh, it's Arundhati Roy, this wonderful writer from India. And I went and I started getting her books and reading her. Now, of course, since then, she's become, I think, one of the most significant figures in the world as a critical voice for peace and justice.
No question about it. Roy is an enormously talented writer, and she has a very analytical mind, a razor-sharp intellect, and she cuts through a lot of the crap and the kind of, a lot of the, homilies and slogans that so dominate public discourse. And she has a very precise writing style. If you read her political essays, or if you read this book, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile,
yeah,
you'll see that she is able to express much in little. And I find that very, very admirable. You know, a lot of us, maybe even myself, tend to be a little long-winded and want to, you know, give many examples and have complicated sentences. And here she has this wonderful talent for simplicity, but with also tremendous accuracy and precision. And it's a rare quality in anyone.
Yeah, it certainly is. We're talking to David Barsamian today, the director of Alternative Radio, a program heard every week on WILL AM 580 at 6 p.m. on Saturdays. David is also the author of two new books, Louder Than Bombs, and also the book we're just talking about, which is really interviews with Arundhati Roy, The Checkbook and The Cruise Missile. Both books are just out, and he's gladly joining us today from his offices in Boulder, Colorado. This is a recorded show, though, I want to let our listeners know. So don't try to call in. Just sit back and listen and enjoy the lovely summer weather. And we hope it's lovely the day this airs. It certainly isn't that great today in Urbana. David, now you've got Alternative Radio, and you say it's roughly on 100 stations in North America. What types of stations in the United States carry it? Is it carried on commercial channels, for example?
Not at all. They tend to be overwhelmingly on community radio stations, such as WORT in Madison, WMNF in Tampa, St. Pete, KBOO in Portland, the Pacifica Network, KGNU in Boulder, and some NPR stations, to their credit, like WIL in Urbana-Champaign, CPN, WCPN in Cleveland. So there are some NPR stations, KALW in San Francisco, that do broadcast the program as well.
Is it the fact that you're charging a lot of money the reason that keeps some of these NPR stations from carrying it?
That must be it. You know, I've been wondering for years, it must be the zero fee to pick the program off the satellite that must be so intimidating to the NPR stations. No, I mean, I know for a fact, and I've written a book about this called The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting, written 2 or 3 years ago, that, you know, I've off the record, when you talk to these program directors and station managers, and it's usually one, perhaps at the most, two people that decide what gets on the air at most of the media outlets. They say the material's too hot. It's going to provoke antagonism. It's going to provoke hostility toward the station, and we don't want to push the envelope. They say openly, you know, it's too hot. It's too controversial. We want to stay within the spectrum of A to B. We don't want to, you know, lengthen it out to A to Z.
Or as Jeff Cohen, the founder of Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, humorously likes to put it, the spectrum that ranges all the way from GE to GM.
Exactly. And so I'm really disappointed in many of the national public radio stations, the affiliates, as well as National Public Radio itself, which produces the two main and most popular news programs in the country today, Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I thought they had a terrific opportunity when Bob Edwards was finally, you know, kind of very abruptly actually shunted aside after almost 25 years as host of Morning Edition to do something really bold and imaginative and get young people to start tuning in, you know, and recruit someone like Laura Flanders to be the host, or Amy Goodman, or Deepa Fernandez, who hosts Free Speech Radio News, or Shannon Service. There's so many talented and brilliant women out there that are doing exciting journalism. But, you know, they opted for the same old, same old. They stayed in-house, and, you know, it continues on and on.
Well, what about alternative radio? I mean, the format of it, I mean, it's not an interview show where you're grilling your guest, is it? I mean, for listeners unfamiliar with it, explain, you know, how you determine what goes on the show and the structure of the program.
Yeah, well, it's a mix. It's not just straight interviews. In fact, more often than not, it tends to be lectures. Occasionally, there are debates and panels. And then I do, you know, an occasional interview, maybe once a month. It's a weekly 1 hour. And so we have one voice, usually, on one particular topic. Let's say I just, in fact, finished producing in the last couple of days a few programs that will be heard on WILL. One is called History Matters, featuring Howard Zinn, the great radical historian, and a speech he gave at Harvard. Another is an interview I did with Chip Brulé on debunking conspiracy theories from JFK to 9/11. And finally, I just produced a program with Michael Parenti, a speech that he gave in Berkeley on fascism, the false revolution. And so we have a complete hour. This is what makes alternative radio so unusual today in all of broadcasting to get that kind of detail and elaboration and explication, you know, over a period of an hour simply doesn't happen. Even in the so-called alternative media, there's a lot of, you know, magazine-style programs, and you may hear, you know, Chomsky for 3 or 4 minutes here or 8 or 10 minutes there, but not in a full-hour format. My idea with the interviews is to get voices on that don't get on the air and to give them an opportunity to actually lay out their ideas, to spell out their philosophy, you know, be it on media matters or U.S. history or propaganda or globalization or the attack on Iraq or on the neocons, and to be a facilitator. You know, I will occasionally challenge some of the assumptions or ask for examples because I'm very interested in examples. I think that's how you show your point. So if you just say, you know, the corporate media are lousy, okay, great, you know, that's a wonderful rhetorical comment. But you have to demonstrate it. You have to show people, well, look, this is what CNN had on yesterday. Let's look at the programming. Let's examine the guest list, what institutions they represent. And then listeners have something concrete to which they can attach that rhetorical observation that the corporate media are lousy with specific examples.
You're listening to David Barsamian today. He's my guest. I'm Bob McChesney on Media Matters on WILL AM 580 here in Urbana, Illinois. This is a pre-recorded show, so please do not try to call in. We taped it shortly before going on air this summer. In David's show, Alternative Radio, which he is the director of and has been producing now for, gosh, 20-some years, David?
Yes.
Past the 25th anniversary, I guess.
Yeah.
Appears on WILL every Saturday night at 6 p.m., but it is also carried on 100 or so stations around the country. And you are, I think it's fair to say, through your experiences and your interest, somewhat of an expert on both community and public radio in the United States and really public media in general. How would you characterize the state of our core public broadcasting institutions that get the most resources, PBS and NPR, the television and radio services today?
Well, PBS in particular is an enormous disappointment. As I outlined, you know, in, I think, detail in my book, Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting, PBS is sometimes laughingly called Petroleum Broadcasting Service. It relies heavily on ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco for a lot of its funding. It's become extremely safe television with one or two notable exceptions, such as the Frontline documentary series and Bill Moyers Now program, which is sadly ending this fall and is being reduced with a new host to a half-hour format. And PBS has, you know, no end of BBC programs. They're almost like a repeating station for BBC drama like the EastEnders and other things like that. Even Antiques Roadshow UK. Some stations like the one in Denver, to its ignominious shame, airs Ed Sullivan reruns as well as Lawrence Welk reruns. That tells you something about the demographic that they're appealing to. Politically, there are other programs, are the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, as well as the Charlie Rose Show. I and Fair and many other media analysts and groups have examined these programs over the years and have come up with, I think, pretty convincing evidence that they play it very safe. They don't push the envelope. They never challenge basic assumptions. So you'll get, you know, a very heated discussion on the Charlie Rose Show with two experts on the U.S. military talking about whether there are enough troops in Iraq. You know, and one will argue, well, it's just the right level. They can do the job. And the other fellow will say, no, it's not enough. We need to increase, you know, the number of troops there, the number of boots on the ground, as they like to say. And Rose, or it doesn't even occur to the guests, ever raise the question of what are the U.S. troops doing in Iraq in the first place? I mean, the basic assumptions are so embedded. For example, I'll give you another example. In late May, during the height of the Abu Ghraib scandal with all the, and I'm not going to use the Orwellian term, abuse, prisoner torture That's what was going on in the U.S.-run prisons in Iraq, torture, as well as at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, as well as in Guantanamo Base in Cuba. Torture is going on, not abuse. And so Lara had on, again, two experts, and the question for the evening was, should Rumsfeld go? And, you know, there was a discussion back and forth. Well, you know, if he's fired, it would send the wrong message to the terrorists that they could, you know, the U.S. can be easily intimidated. And the other person would say, no, well, for the good of the military, you know, he should resign, or Bush should, you know, gently push him out. And that was the range of the debate. And I thought, well, yes, I think Rumsfeld should go. He should go where? He should go to The Hague at the International Criminal Court. He should be seated right next to Slobodan Milosevic and face an international war crimes tribunal. He is responsible for major war crimes. There is no outlet on NPR or PBS, and forget about the corporate media, where you can even utter these terms, where you can say the word war crime with and couple it with the United States.
We're talking to David Barsamian today on Media Matters. Again, the pre-recorded show. Don't try to call in. Just sit back and enjoy the show. In addition to the NPR stations and the PBS system in the United States, of course, we also have the community network of stations like WEFT here in Urbana, our local outstanding community station. And you've listed a number of them also earlier in the show, David. And this is really the bulk of your network, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Community radio is...
What's the difference between community radio and the NPR stations? Because I think a lot of our listeners, it's just they're both sort of non-commercial stations.
They are and they aren't. Structurally, they're quite different in terms of the way they operate. Community-run stations overwhelmingly rely on volunteers with a small paid staff, and the programming primarily comes from the community. That is to say, there is some outside programming coming in via satellite and MP3 and other sources, but most of the programming, like let's take one station that you're familiar with, WRT in Madison, one of the premier and one of the oldest community radio stations in the United States, the bulk of the programming is locally produced. Now, at the NPR stations, I mean, they're both public in a sense. The bulk of the programming overwhelmingly comes from the outside. Most of the staffs tend to be very small, they're professional, and they're paid, and there's very little volunteer input. Volunteers may help out during bake sales and garage sales and during fundraising membership drives, but generally volunteers at most of the NPR stations do not have access to the airwaves. And that's the big difference between community and NPR stations. And I must say, because of the nature of community radio, they tend to take more chances. They're more daring politically. They'll challenge the official thinking. They dare to go outside the box and, you know, broadcast programs that are very critical of Bush economic policies or the attack on Iraq or what's going on in Afghanistan and things like that. And so there is, in content, as well as the flavor, it's interesting that you live in a community, Urbana-Champaign, where you can get that flavor just by moving the dial a little bit. You can listen to WEFT and then sample WILL, the station we're on right now, and see the difference in the programming.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to David Barsamian again, the author of the new book, Louder Than Bombs, which is a series of interviews he conducted for The Progressive Magazine. You've been doing interviews for The Progressive Magazine now for many years. Some of our listeners might not be familiar with The Progressive. David, what is that?
Well, it's America's oldest monthly, political monthly. It was founded in 1909 by the great progressive populist Bob La Follette, who later went on to be a senator from Wisconsin. Recently, in early May, I must say, the Progressive celebrated its 95th birth anniversary with Howard Zinn and many other luminaries that came to Madison. Its current editor is Matt Rothschild, who I think is doing a terrific job at the monthly, and the previous editor, someone that I really am very fond of and admired greatly, and someone who encouraged me enormously, was Irwin Knoll. Sadly, Irwin died in the early 1990s.
It was just about 10 years ago, exactly, nine and a half years ago.
Yeah, he's deeply missed, and he always pushed me. You know, he used to do an interview show himself, and he was always telling me, you know, David, do this, do that. And it's great to have a kind of a mentor who actually has been around the block and is not trying to diss you and to belittle you or humiliate you, but actually empower you and make you better. I think we all need those kinds of teachers to push us along. And so Erwin continues to be an inspiration.
You know, in the book, you have an interview with Noam Chomsky, and I think, I don't know how many times you've interviewed Noam Chomsky, but I have to imagine it's in three digits at this
point. I think it's in the Guinness Book of Records at this point, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've interviewed Noam Chomsky for, you know, decades now. Your names are, when you hear the name Barsamian, you almost always expect to hear Chomsky soon thereafter, because you have interviewed Noam so often. And he's in this book, but you've also done numerous books of just interviews with Chomsky, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, one particularly I think may be of interest to your readers. It's called Propaganda and the Public Mind.
Mm-hmm.
This came out a couple of years ago, and it really documents the uses of propaganda and how the broadcast media have become a kind of conveyor belt for official think, for groupthink, you know, as produced in the Beltway. And as I say often, that they've become stenographers to power. And so Chomsky traces this back actually to a period in the 1930s where, you know, you had the development of propaganda, and even before then, during World War I, when the first propaganda agencies was set up in the U.S. and in Britain to persuade their recalcitrant populations to, you know, about the nobility of getting involved and staying in World War I. And so Chomsky is able to, you know, deconstruct the major tropes of propaganda. I mean, you see it during the entire period of the period of mourning for President Reagan, for example. I mean, the level of obfuscation was simply staggering. I mean, it was barely possible to recognize the actual record of Reagan in his 8 years as president and what was being said about him. There is such a gap there in terms of reality, and the media have simply been totally uncritical. They did not raise questions about Reagan's involvement in supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
Yeah, if I can interject here, David, I mean, there was a lot of talk during the Reagan memorial services, not a lot, but some, about his record in Central America and the wars there, and then the Iran-Contra scandal. But as you just pointed out, there were other issues that could have been raised, and why don't you just talk a little bit about those?
Well, even before Afghanistan, let me talk about Southern Africa, where Reagan was a diehard supporter of the apartheid regime. You'll recall in the 1980s there were wide-scale protests throughout the United States and around the world calling on for disinvestment, for the U.S. to distance itself from the apartheid regime in South Africa.
And the
Reagan administration didn't budge. They were totally devoted to it. And in neighboring countries such as Mozambique and Angola, the United States allied itself with organized gangs of mercenaries, most notably RENAMO and UNITA. RENAMO in Mozambique and UNITA in Angola. Jonas Savimbi was the leader of, he was a homicidal maniac, if I may say. Over a million people died in each of those countries in wars that the U.S. supported. Now, that's been totally unmentioned. Of course, when it comes to Africa and the media, it's only when there's a catastrophe, if there's some enormous death or AIDS epidemic, that we ever hear about Africa. It is so far off the radar screen, which is, I think, an enormous tragedy. And now, to talk about Afghanistan, one of the books I did was with Iqbal Ahmed. It's called Terrorism, Theirs and Ours. And on the cover, you see there's a color photograph of some turbaned, bearded men in, you know, in their kurta pajama, in their salwar kameez, the traditional dress of South and West Asia, sitting with none other than Ronald Reagan. I mean, these were the very people that he called freedom fighters. These were the very people that were later to morph into the Taliban and ultimately into Al-Qaeda. So I say that there's an oblique line between Reagan and what he did in supporting the Afghan Mujahideen in the 1980s and what happened on September 11th. Now, that may raise some eyebrows, but I think the evidence is quite persuasive that the United States created a blowback situation by generously funding the Afghan Mujahideen through and also with the help of, I must say, two of the closest allies of the United States, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, the latter having the most fundamentalist, puritanical, misogynist, homophobic regime possibly in the world. They poured billions of dollars into the Islamic madrasas, the seminaries run in Pakistan. The CIA provided all the weapons and the training for the Afghan Mujahideen. And this, of course, was part of Reagan's great crusade to break the Soviet Union.
We're talking to David Barsamian today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Barsamian is the director of Alternative Radio, the program which is heard weekly on WILL AM 580 at 6 p.m. on Saturdays and can be heard on 100 stations or so in North America. He's also the author of numerous books, including two brand new books, a collection of interviews he's done in the Progressive magazine called Louder Than Bombs, which has just come out. And in addition, a series of interviews or conversations with Arundhati Roy, The Checkbook, and The Cruise Missile, both of which I urge you all to check out. And we're doing this show pre-recorded, so don't try to call in. Just sit back and let David and me do the talking. David, in the interview, you've got a number of people interviewed in Louder Than Bombs. Another figure that you have an interview with who you've dealt with over the years is Ralph Nader. And Ralph Nader is now planning or intending to run for president again in 2004. And he has become a much more controversial figure as a result of his electoral aspirations. What's your take on Ralph Nader? What sort of person is he, and what do you make of what he's doing in 2004?
Well, he has my utmost respect and admiration for what he's accomplished over one of the most brilliant careers of any American that comes to mind. I mean, even Life magazine named him one of the most 100 influential Americans of the 20th century. So his record is quite impressive, what he's accomplished in terms of protections for workers, protections for drivers and car safety, auto regulations and things like that. But in terms of his political choices, and I must tell you, I voted for Nader in 1996 and in 2000. I think this year the stakes are so high that I don't agree with Ralph Nader's decision to run for president. I think it's particularly urgent that this administration, which Chomsky calls particularly cruel and savage, be repudiated. Now, this is not a ringing endorsement for John Kerry. I will vote for Kerry, quite frankly. But it is more about repudiating this gang of hawks, militarists, who are hell-bent on establishing a Pax Americana out of the barrel of a gun. These are the people who have invaded and occupied Iraq and have wrecked that country. These are the people who are wrecking the economy of the United States. These are the people who are looting from the Social Security Fund in order to cover their enormous deficits. These are the people that are spending almost $500 billion on weapons of mass destruction. So I think Ralph Nader has misjudged the gravity of this particular moment. Yes, we know there isn't a huge amount of difference between the two parties, but this group, and I'm now speaking in the words of Howard Zinn, who told me very recently, this particular group, he said the Bush administration is the worst in American history. Now, that's from the premier radical historian of this country, who's, you know, soon to turn 82 years old. He is saying this is the worst administration in U.S. history. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us to do whatever we can to oust these people and then to put pressure on Kerry to adopt a more progressive stance, particularly on international issues. I'm not very sanguine about his pronouncements on Israel-Palestine or on Iraq, for that matter. But on domestic issues, I think there is a good deal of difference between Bush and Kerry. And Chomsky himself has endorsed Kerry. He said there's a fraction of difference between the two, but it's worth it. I do want to just mention someone else beyond Ralph Nader, and that is Iqbal Ahmed, one of the great post-colonial anti-imperialist thinkers who was born in India in 1935, emigrated to Pakistan during the partition in 1947. He was Edward Said's kind of alter ego and also very, very close friend of Edward Said. Sadly, they've both passed on in the last few years. And I remember in one of the interviews in Louder Than Bombs, talking to Iqbal Ahmed. This is in 1998 in Amherst, and he was talking about bin Laden. He had gone to Afghanistan, and he had met bin Laden. And this is at a time when, you know, not many people have ever heard of bin Laden, or, you know, except for specialists in the field. And he told me then, in a very prophetic statement, he said, Osama bin Laden is a sign of things to come. You cannot address the problems of terrorism by using cruise missiles. You have to go to the roots of the problem. And just think about that now with what we are, what the Bush administration is trying to address the problems of terrorism using cruise missiles. You'll notice in early June of this year that the Spanish police have conducted extensive criminal investigations and have apprehended many of the people involved in the tragic bombing of the trains in Madrid. They treated this as a criminal action that, you know, was really necessary for the police to organize around and to pursue, not to attack Morocco. I mean, if you follow the logic of the Bush administration, since most of the terrorists that were allegedly involved in the plot to blow up the trains were from Morocco, then Spain should have launched an all-out attack on Morocco. That's the Bush doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Iqbal Ahmed very succinctly and with great insight was able to, you know, isolate these things. Of course, you know, someone punches you, you want to punch them back. But you have to think, you know, the weapons that the United States has at its disposal are so ferocious, they are so overwhelming that, you know, of course war should be the last resort. But with this group, again, this extremely militaristic group of people like Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Douglas Fife and Louis Libby and John Bolton and Steve Carboni and Jerry Boykin and all of them, you know, buried in the Pentagon or in the Defense Policy Board, all of them are dedicated to shooting first.
David Barsamian, what, you know, in your 20, 25 years of doing the shows and in your interviews and your published work, is there any single issue that's the most controversial issue when you turn to it? You can always expect the biggest outcry, the biggest reaction. Anything that jumps out from your experience?
Well, I don't have to think too long on that. It's, of course, Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Israel is the third rail in American political discourse. Before, it used to be Social Security. Perhaps some of the older listeners will remember. It was so off limits to talk about Social Security, tampering with it. It was almost like something sacred. And, of course, that is also one of the, I think, negative accomplishments of Ronald Reagan, where Social Security was being discussed as something that needed to be reformed. Now, what do these neocons mean when they say reform? They mean essentially to eliminate, to privatize, to move monies into the private sector. So historically, Social Security has been the third rail in American political discourse. That has now been replaced by any discussion of Israel. I'll give you a perfect example. I did a program with a Lebanese American. Her name is Rania Masri, brilliant young woman, very you know, very smart, talking about Iraq and the privatization of military duties, the outsourcing of jobs to Halliburton, to Bechtel, to Blackwell, to Vinnell and Northrop Grumman and these other private corporations. And I got a number of calls, very hostile, because she also happened to mention that the Iraqi people are never going to go along with recognizing Israel. And people almost immediately said, you know, she's a Jew hater. The typical thing, if you criticize Israel, if you're not Jewish, you're a Holocaust denier, you're a Nazi, you're a Jew hater. I mean, this is just appalling. It's a new kind of communism. You know, it's a new kind of McCarthyism. You smear people with these very hateful and, you know, full of opprobrium types of comments, which are very intimidating. Nobody likes to be called a Nazi or a Holocaust denier or a Jew hater or an anti-Semite. The people that happen to be Jewish, like Chomsky and Zinn and Norman Finkelstein and others who are critical of Israel, that doesn't work for them, so they're called self-hating Jews. And I think this is deplorable. We need to have a clear, open, honest discussion about a country to which the United States gives on an annual basis about $4 billion, that gives it enormous political and diplomatic support. It has extensive military dealings with that country. What is the problem in talking about Israel? You see, it's like what a lot of the conservative talk show hosts have been doing ever since 9/11. If you're American and you criticize the Bush administration policies, you're ipso facto anti-American. I mean, what does that mean? I think, as Howard Zinn says, dissent in a time of war is the highest form of patriotism. We need more dissent. When our young men and women, and not so very young men and women, I just noticed a guy 59 years old that was killed in Iraq.
I saw that too, yeah.
59 years old. This is no you know kid that just graduated from high school and couldn't find a job in Walmart like Jessica Lynch, which is one of the reasons she joined the military. A lot of these guys and women are from the National Guard and Reserves, and they never thought they'd be called up at this age to fight in combat particularly. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to be able to talk about not just the policies of the Israeli government that does not make you an anti-Semite or a Jew hater. And clearly, I mean, we have to also acknowledge something. There is a horrible thing called anti-Semitism. There are people, for totally irrational reasons, who hate Jews and Jewish people and Judaism. This is totally unacceptable. And wherever people of conscience encounter this kind of hateful behavior, we have to be in the forefront of denouncing it. Let's put that aside. We can recognize, I think we're all intelligent enough to recognize clear examples of anti-Semitism and criticisms of a political policy of a state. Give us a little credit, please. You know, we people can understand the difference between these things. And so Israel today is, I did a lot of work with Edward Said, mm-hmm. The Columbia mm-hmm. University professor who died in September of 2003, Palestinian American. He did more than anyone else to alert not just the people of the United States, but basically the people of the world, that there was a question of Palestine.
And there are two interviews with Said in Louder Than Bombs.
He's the only one, actually, that has two interviews, because he's such a significant figure on a topic that no one wants to confront. No one wants to deal with this. I mean, Said himself received many, many death threats. His office was vandalized and firebombed. These are not pleasant things. I mean, no one likes to pick up the phone and says, you're a Jew hater. We know where you live. We're going to get you. These are awful things, and so a lot of people get intimidated. They don't speak out. But Said was a man of great personal courage and of enormous intellectual accomplishment. And, he never withered. He never, right to the end, he was always talking about Palestine and about justice for the Palestinian people, while recognizing the historical injustices that have occurred to the Jewish people. But one does not cancel out the other. Said always said that there are communities of suffering. The Jews and the Palestinians in Palestine and Israel are communities of suffering, and they have gone through a lot. And one doesn't justify, one type of suffering or the magnitude of one suffering should not allow one group to have privilege over another group.
You know, David Barsamian, you know, I go down the list of the people you interview in general, but also especially in Louder Than Bombs, and you've mentioned many of the names, Nader, Chomsky, Zinn, Said, Ahmad, Taylor Branch, the great historian, Danny Glover, John Pilger, Tariq Ali. The list goes on and on, Kurt Vonnegut. You know, I think a lot of our listeners are pretty envious. You're saying this isn't a bad gig. You know, you get to talk to these really brilliant and talented people from a broad range of experiences and backgrounds and interests. Is it hard to do this? I mean, when you try to get a hold of a Noam Chomsky, do you have to go through like six or seven agents and deal with his people out on the coast? How does that work?
Well, it's you know, since I've been doing this for so long, I do have quite a bit of access. And I consider myself very lucky to be able to, you know, reach these people, to talk to them. For example, you know, I just called Kurt Vonnegut out of the blue. You know, he picked up the phone, and, you know, I did an interview with him in his home on the east side of Manhattan. And there are usually not a lot of layers around the kind of voices that I'm interested in interviewing and promoting on the air and in print. It's more around celebrities, you know, rock stars and movie stars. And I'm not, they don't need me. They've got PR machines working 24/7. So mostly, you know, I can, you know, you call Chomsky, picks up the phone. You call Howard Zinn, picks up the phone. There aren't layers of concentric circles around these people, protecting them.
Now, when I go down the list here in Louder Than Bombs, look at the people. You said there are some people, now some of these are very famous people our listeners are all familiar with. We've mentioned their names, Chomsky, Zinn, Nader, et cetera. Are there some young people or some new names here, some fresh names that you think when people read this book, they're going to sort of say, wow, who's this?
Well, in particular, Edwidge Danica of Haiti. She's a Haitian-American, a novelist and short story writer who's very politically aware of what's going on in the Caribbean and in Haiti particular. She's, you know, in her 20s, quite a prolific writer and very, very brilliant. I mean, she's being talked about in terms of the Pulitzer Prize, if not for her latest book, The Dewbreakers, then for some book coming up very soon. She's a wonderful, wonderful voice. Eduardo Galeano of Uruguay is not a household name in the United States. I've really been glad to, you know, hopefully introduce his voice to more people here. He's a writer, a political analyst, essayist from Uruguay. He's also a columnist in the Progressive magazine, and his classic work, which I must say is kind of the Latin American equivalent of A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, is called Open Veins of Latin America. It's very much like the Zinn book, from the bottom up, from what happened to the peoples of Latin America as they were conquered by mostly Spain, but also Portugal, and then later by the United States. So it's the book is a mix. There's the wonderful Ben Bagdikian, who wrote the classic book, The Media Monopoly, which just came out in its seventh edition. Ben is a pioneer in the field of media studies. You can literally, you know, not talk about media criticism and corporate control without some reference to Bagdikian's work. And I'm glad to say there's a certain professor at Urbana-Champaign who's really picked up that baton. I can't quite get his name. I think it's McCracken.
It's something like that.
Google.
Some crazy name.
Who is also writing extremely important books on the media and is leading a crucial fight to democratize the media. So hats off to whoever that anonymous professor might be.
Well, thank you, David, for that nice plug there. One other author that, or one other person you interview in Louder Than Bombs that I think some people might be familiar with, but probably not a likely candidate for the sort of lineup that you'd normally see in a book of interviews or interviews in the Progressive, and that's Taylor Branch. What do you tell our listeners about Taylor Branch?
Taylor Branch is one of our preeminent historians. He's from the South and comes from a working class background. I think his parents ran a dry cleaning business in the South, in North Carolina. And he's written a series of books on the civil rights movement. Parting the Waters is one. Pillar of Fire is another. These are extremely valuable and important contributions to our understanding of a kind of revolution that occurred in this country, pretty much under the radar of the media for most of the period until the mid-60s or so, early 60s, with the March on Washington in 63. And so Branch has really, I think, captured the essence of that movement and also its applications for today. How can civil movements for civil rights and social justice, how can they proceed? I think if we look at the model of what happened in the 1950s and 60s, we can learn quite a bit and draw a great deal of encouragement. We have to remember this was a time in the South. It's not very long ago, certainly within the lifetime of many of the people listening to this program.
Well, the two of us.
Certainly, that the entire structure of the Southern apparatus was completely antagonistic toward African Americans. I mean, they controlled the police, they controlled the judiciary system, they controlled the state house, they controlled the legislature. I mean, overwhelming odds to try and do anything, you know, to change that situation, given the preponderance of power that was concentrated in the hands of the apartheid forces, the segregationist forces. And Taylor Branch, in this masterful series of books, has gone down meticulously, you know, with great detail, and with quite a bit of skill as a writer, to demonstrate and to show how it's possible to change things. You know, Americans are always saying, a lot of them anyway, feel, well, you can't fight City Hall. It's just, you know, it's hopeless out there. There's too much power. What difference does it make? They'll do what they want to do. You know, we're all familiar with these kinds of cynical comments that are made, which really exemplifies a kind of enfeebledness of democracy. So almost the oxygen has been sucked out of democracy, and you hear it in these kinds of statements. Oh, it doesn't matter. Why bother voting? And who cares? And, you know, the powerful will do what they want to do, and, you know, it doesn't matter. Let's go watch the game or something and have a beer. And I think if we look at our recent past, we can find, as Taylor Branch does, many examples that can inspire us today. Look at the advantages we have. We have programs like this, which didn't exist, you know, in the 1950s when Branch was writing about the civil rights movements. We have publishers like the South End Press. It's like South End Press, which published Louder Than Bombs and The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, which didn't exist in that period. So we have lots of new institutions. We have the Internet now. We have all kinds. We have Seven Stories Press. We have a plethora of new media that have exploded across the landscape. Free Speech TV, located here in Boulder, Colorado, and on and on. And that's very encouraging. So we have a lot of tools. And I think, you know, the negativity can be really self-defeating. And, you know, if we want to work toward a just America where there is equality, where our country is not tarnished as it is now with the label of imperialist and warmonger and the other very unflattering terms that are attached to the United States, I think, you know, we can make a difference. Listeners to this program can make a difference. It all happens one at a time.
David Barsamian, as you know, I share your optimism, and I'm inspired by it even. But I have to ask you, back in 1978 when you started alternative radio, if someone said, well, David, you know, 26 years from now, this is what America is going to look like. This is who the president's going to be. This is going to be the military situation. This is what's going to happen to economic equality and social equality. Would you have said, wow, that's really exciting? Or what would your response have been?
Well, my response in 1978 would have been, I probably would have gasped. I would have grabbed the respirator and have taken a very deep breath. I must say, after very significant victories in the late 1960s and early 1970s, that there has been a real decline in many areas on the political front. The weakening of the two-party system, the corporatization of politics in this country, $1, one vote, the increasing concentration of the media. These trends were there even in 78. One could not have predicted the acceleration, I think, that we've seen in the last few years in particular. And let's not forget, it was the infamous 1996 Telecommunications Act, pushed very strongly by Clinton and Gore, that has allowed for this tsunami of takeovers and mergers in the media, which has really changed the landscape of the country in many, many ways.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, because, and I'm listening to you, and I've always been, when I've read your work, you know, I always wonder, where does David Barsamian get his news about the world, to get his input? What media are you consuming on a daily basis to help you get around what's the official journalism that we get in our culture?
Well, you know, I'm largely self-taught. I don't consider myself, you know, an intellectual or in any way have any academic credentials. But I read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Business Week. The corporate media itself gives a lot away if you're able to decode the propaganda. If you're able to read between the lies, there's a lot of information there. This is something that Chomsky and Ed Herman have pointed out many, many times, that the elite, the ruling class, if you will, they need precise information. They need to know what's going on in Aceh, in Sumatra, in Indonesia, because they're thinking about, you know, investing in Aceh. And if there's civil unrest there, if people are unhappy with the government in Jakarta, then that's very important information for them to know. And so if you read the corporate media carefully, you can glean an enormous amount of information. Even reports on National Public Radio, on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, I listen to them. I listen to Free Speech Radio News. I listen to the BBC World News. I watch the BBC TV World News report. I try whenever possible to access The Independent and The Guardian, daily newspapers in Britain. You can access them online. I get The Guardian Weekly, which also has excerpts from Le Monde Diplomatique that's translated. I go to the Indian press, the Pakistani press. There's an enormous amount of dissident information that challenges the you know, the kind of official stories that are out there. But it does take, you know, you have to be a little adventuresome. You have to look. You can't wait to see it at a 7-Eleven checkout counter or at your nearest airport, you know, with the magazines. So you have to, you know, you have to look for The Nation, The Progressive, In These Times, Z Magazine, Clamor. There are all kinds of online and offline magazines. I mean, the internet has really exploded the whole information spectrum. I must say, there's a magazine I rely on heavily. It's called Monthly Review. It's out of New York.
Okay. David Barsamian, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters. David Barsamian is the author of the new book, Louder Than Bombs, published by South End Press, and the other new book, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, which is Conversations with Arundhati Roy. He is the director of Alternative Radio, which can be heard on WILL every 6 p.m. on Saturday. David Barsamian, thank you for joining us today on Media Matters.
Thanks so much, Bob.
All right, and I'll see you all next week at this time. Goodbye.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, an opera and classical music festival in Watseka, Illinois, August 6th through 8th, featuring Gounod's tragic opera Romeo and Juliet. More information at sugarcreekfestival.org.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the mid-70s and southwest winds around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight, the low in the upper 50s with southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the morning, then showers and thunderstorms likely in the afternoon. The high in the upper 70s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.